What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Speak.
Who am I?
Your name is Kal-El. You are the only survivor of the planet Krypton. Even though you've been raised as a human being, you are not one of them.
Being a film critic has never felt more heroic.
Film Spotting listeners can be a great people, Josh. They only lack the light to show the way.
Like bad-mouthing the Marx Brothers, that kind of light?
Well, we still got a few kinks to work out there, Super Josh. Jor-El sent his only son through time and space to become a beacon of goodness for the people of Earth. So this week's top five, what else? Movie Christ figures.
Plus, our review of the latest Superman reboot, Man of Steel. That and more.
You're looking at my underwear, aren't you, Super Josh?
That is a nice shade of purple, Michael. All that is ahead on Film Spotting.
I'm Sam Van Holgren, Film Spotting producer. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now online store. Check out their new commerce solution so you can start selling stuff immediately. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase of new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use code FILM6. And by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from in every genre. Couple of recommendations. Like many of you, I'm going to be spending some time on the road this summer. My five-year-old and I will be driving from Minnesota to New Hampshire, 4th of July weekend, about, if calculations are correct, 25 hours in the car, and I'm not even thinking about the ride back when my wife and two-year-old join us. So I've been thinking about things to do to help while away the hours, like audiobooks, and my five-year-old's a little quick to become unnerved, a little skittish, so the few that I'm considering are a little on the safe side. Old classics that you'll all recognize, I'm sure, but they all come very highly rated on the Audible website. Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, read by the author. We're headed to New England, so a bit of the main author's Down East accent should help adapt my son to his new surroundings. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Roald Dahl, of course, unabridged. It's read by Douglas Hodge in this recording, and it's a new one, just released this month, enhanced with special sound effects. And as long as none of them are courtesy of Tim Burton and Johnny Depp, we should be okay. Winnie the Pooh, A.A. Milne, unabridged, read by Peter Dennis. And if the narration is half as wonderful as the book itself is, I don't think I'll mind the nearly 3 hours in Pooh's company a bit. And finally, Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie, it's unabridged. It's narrated by Jim Dale. And because, of course, it's Peter Pan, but actually because the narrator, Jim Dale, you may or may not know him, but his reputation as a reader of audiobooks precedes him, most famously, of the Harry Potter series. So if your kids are slightly older than mine, Audible makes it very easy to search for age-appropriate stuff. You can always send your own Audible recommendations to Adam and Josh at feedback@filmspotting.net or post them on the Film Spotting Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting. And for a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audible.com/filmspotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar is off this week. So joining me is our regular guest, Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. Michael, I don't think I'm supposed to tell you this, but Adam is actually at the Film Spotting Fortress of Solitude. Michael and I are grateful that we saved our notes from high school English class as we prepped for this week's Film Spotting Top 5 Movie Christ Figures.
So how did you do on your Lord of the Flies paper there, John?
Hey, I've got the conch, so I don't have to answer that. Let's get to our review of Man of Steel.
I have so many questions. Where do I come from? Have to decide what kind of man you want to grow up to be, Clark.
whoever that man is, he's going to change the world.
Man of Steel, the latest reboot of the Warner Brothers superhero franchise, has many new things, including British star Henry Cavill in the lead role. But one element it has carried over from the 1978 original film is the casting of a major Hollywood figure in the part of Jor-El, Superman's father from the planet Krypton. In 78, we got Marlon Brando. Here we have Russell Crowe, who gets a good deal more screen time than Brando did, plus the chance to ride on a giant cicada. I think that's what it is at the beginning there. This decision on the part of screenwriter David S. Goyer, director Zack Snyder, and producer Christopher Nolan may have backfired, however. In considering the box office slide the picture took in its second week of release, the LA Times' Betsy Sharkey wondered if the emphasis on Jor-El may be part of the reason. As she wrote, the film turns to Jor-El for historical context, and Superman comes with a lot of historical baggage. Apparently, the filmmakers believe they have a lot of explaining to do. I think Sharkey is onto something. At least that was a large part of my resistance to the picture. And it's not just Jor-El. Man of Steel is loaded with all sorts of unnecessary backstory and Krypton minutiae. Did this bother you too, Michael? And better yet, let me ask you the question that I started my written review of Man of Steel with. Does any movie really need a world engine, a phantom drive, and a Genesis chamber? Little much. Come on. It's a little lot. Much.
It's a you're talking about a trilogy's worth of expository hoo-ha there anyway. But I don't know, Josh. I think I was a little reluctant to embrace Sharkey's basic argument in that LA Times commentary that it pins the box office. I don't even really like looking at any box office numbers.
It's hard to read those tea leaves.
Yeah, but I think it's I don't think audiences are necessarily resisting, if they are to the degree they are resisting Man of Steel. I don't think they're resisting it because it gets a little thick in some of the expository passages. Because I frankly think some of the, and I'm not such a unrepresentative member of the audience, I think that, those scenes where Crowe's Jor-El has to do this sort of visual PowerPoint presentation that has actually some very interesting computer graphics in this sort of like Russian constructivist silvery black and white style that kind of gives you the whole history.
They gussy it up quite a bit. I'll give
cool.
you that.
It look, it, to me, it was actually some of the more interesting filmmaking in the director Zack Snyder's picture, but I think there's a simpler explanation why people aren't really telling their friends, hey, go see it, or they're seeing it maybe a second time themselves. I think that last hour is a chore.
Yeah.
It's a chore. And this is the section of the film. It's roughly a 2.5 hour picture. This is the section of the film that where they're turning most of that hour over to two immensely long battle sequences that grind on and on and on. And when you get a response from an audience of sheer exhaustion and enough already from both of those fight sequences, you have people kind of walking out like they've been kind of run over by a steamroller. And that's what I felt. That's what I sensed.
For me, yeah, it's probably a double whammy because I didn't care for the first part of this film or that final section that you're talking about. The final section is really just a lot of punching. And it gets to a very specific problem with the character of Superman is that he is invincible. Mm-hmm. So you punch him, it doesn't hurt. He punches Zod, it doesn't hurt because Zod has powers on Earth too. And we get a lot of this back and forth where by the time one of them is thrown, I don't even remember which one it is, thrown from the surface of Earth into a satellite in outer space and then just comes back. I mean, there's nothing really for us to be concerned about when they never get hurt. And that's why these action scenes seem to go on and on and on. And the other problem is most of the action is between two computer-generated figures, it seems to me, instead of actors who we get even, that removes us even more. Do you know what I mean? It's
well,
not only
no,
that they can't get hurt, it's that they're not even people.
There's no what you'd call old-fashioned fight choreography because of this problem you mentioned, the sort of the digital overload. But I think I experienced the fights in a different way than you did, Josh, in that I did. Yes, these characters are essentially impervious to pain, but the level of destruction and really kind of just a hand-to-hand physical violence is kind of grotesque. I mean, in other words, people get thrown through not just one building, but 17 buildings.
Sure.
So that, you know, Metropolis by the end, and again, this is conscious by design, looks a lot like New York 9/11, you know, September 11th, 2001. And that's all those echoes, those visual echoes of real pain and destruction are deliberate and they're extremely heavy-handed. And I think they just sit on the damn movie.
You are weak, son of El. Unsure of yourself. The fact that you possess a sense of morality and we do not gives us an evolutionary advantage. And if history has proven anything, it is that evolution always wins.
Do you think spectacle filmmakers in the back of their minds, maybe not consciously, but in the back of their minds feel like they have to compete with 9/11? Somehow it's having something of that scale in reality that now when we go to a movie, they're almost seeing it as competition. How am I going to, I mean, this sounds grossly insensitive, but there have been a number of Hollywood summer films now where we talk about this, how they're reminiscent of 9/11.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that is almost this sense of we've got to give something not just to evoke it, but to be bigger or more amazing and capture the audience's attention in a way that that original reality horror did. I just wonder if that's what's happening.
It can be done. I think it's a good question. A lot of this comes back to the director and writer Christopher Nolan, who did the Dark Knight trilogy and who had a story credit on this latest Superman picture, Man of Steel. I think he's at least a writer and a director working on a level of, I guess, arguably moral intelligence, where you're at least, you can argue with whether or not you like The Dark Knight or The Dark Knight Returns, or if you think they went too far. But especially that middle Batman picture, The Dark Knight, I felt like the real world dread and really queasy kind of moral and ethical dilemmas in the middle of all the violence made the picture hold together. And
sure,
I think the stakes felt very high, but without feeling really punishing to the audience. Now, by the third Batman picture, The Dark Knight Returns, and really throughout a lot of Zack Snyder's Superman film, I just felt like enough or too much. And people can evoke 9/11 in all sorts of commercial popcorn ways that don't offend me. Steven Spielberg's, there's a few scenes in War of the Worlds mm-hmm. that consciously kind of get at this very ashen-laden, you know, this ashen sky, you know, this urban destruction and sort of an awful sense of dread and just the scale of the pain and the suffering. And yet, I don't feel cheap for being excited or kind of like strung along by the
maybe
suspense.
It's not a crutch as it sometimes feels here to rely on that.
Right. I mean, look, Spielberg's better than Michael Bay in that department. I mean, the Michael Bay Transformers films are full of images.
He's probably
like
better
that.
Than him in a few departments.
Yeah,
but
now they're business partners. They work together.
I know.
Spielberg's name on the Transformers
yes.
series kind of eroding his own reputation with every billion these movies make. But I think I saw Man of Steel twice, and I didn't really want to, but my son, who's 12, wanted to take a couple of pals, and I thought, well, I'll go again, just to kind of see how it plays with an audience. And really, everybody kind of was very mixed on it and did feel just kind of exhausted by that last hour. And I think that's the problem with the movie. I don't think the problem is whatever expository nonsense they get tripped up on at the beginning of the film or the middle. Audiences, Josh, forgive all that nonsense, all expository overloads they put up with in all kinds of films. If it comes before the midpoint of the film, they're willing to overlook it last hour works.
Audiences might, but I can't. This goes back to a problem I had with a summer film from last year that we actually reviewed together with Adam on the show, Prometheus, which was full of this sort of myth-making and lore and world-building and even worse, world-explaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like you were exhausted by the end of Man of Steel. I was exhausted by the time the first 40 minutes were over just from getting all of that. And the problem here, I know that the 78 Superman has that as well. Mm-hmm. There's a long section at the beginning with Brando.
Yeah, nobody.
No,
look, nobody went to that movie for the first 40 minutes. So I remember that. Yeah.
Maybe that was it. And there it seemed to have been pretty much dropped once they moved on. Brando does make one reappearance. But here, Crow doesn't go away. And worse than that, Michael Shannon as Zod, he picks up the reins and starts explaining to us about the technology of Krypton and what his plans are and his relationship to the history of Krypton. In a sense, we never leave the planet, even though we get to Earth. And I think that this story's root is Superman's experience on Earth among humans and learning how to live among them and relate to them. That's where we really get a sense. That's where this story at least hooks me. And here I felt like it was almost an alien invasion picture. We got a lot of aliens, very little of his relationship with the people on Earth. And that especially seemed like a misstep because I thought Kevin Costner was fantastic as Superman's adoptive dad.
I do like a lot of the casting in this film, Josh. And then I guess that's one of the reasons I think it's not a failure. And even though I liked it, you know, I was mixed the first time. I was actually quite a bit less than mixed by the second time I saw Man of Steel. But I like those scenes in Smallville. I think the casting of Costner, as you say, Diane Lane, very good. And I'd say really, you know, Michael Shannon, in the limited scope of that role, bringing his interstellar glare of doom to everything, I think he's quite good. My issue with it up and down is whether or not you think the director, Zack Snyder, can film action in an interesting way. And really the answer is essentially no. Snyder, to me, is really just sort of a talented lunkhead. You know, in a film like Watchmen, which I found kind of reprehensible, I think he was trying to approximate the stylized level of extreme violence he got in the graphic novel, which is like it or not, a very clever and well-written achievement. And I just felt like, you know, in some ways, the violence you get in Man of Steel, yes, it's comic book violence, but it's, he doesn't have the visual imagination to make it make sense in a movie. It's just, to me, it just feels like pound, 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 pound.
I'm going to say that Sucker Punch is Snyder's reprehensible film.
Oh, my God.
Watchmen. But I think that's a case of the material. I think he did have good material with Watchmen, and that helped quite a bit. You're listening to Film Spotting. This is Josh Larson with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. Adam Kempinar is taking the week off. And I do want to go back to the casting that you were talking about, that you pretty much appreciated who they put in this film. The one reason I was really excited about this movie, because I'm not a huge Superman guy, was Michael Shannon as Zod. Terrence Stamp made that original role iconic for this genre, and Shannon seemed like the kind of actor who'd be able to step, as Ledger did. You know, you might think we want to stay away from a villain role that someone had already established as their own. Jack Nicholson did it with the Joker, then Ledger made it really even better, I feel like, in The Dark Knight. So I was excited about seeing what Shannon was going to do, if he was going to be up to the challenge, and I feel like he backed away from it. I mean, this is a guy that I love him in just about everything he does, and he seemed to almost make a conscious decision to underplay Zod in a lot of ways. He does have that glare, that's right, and maybe it's because he just has to give all this exposition that he's undercut by the screenplay, but I didn't think he had much presence at all as Zod. It was a huge disappointment for me.
Not so much for me. I think given the material and the kind of monomaniacal nature of that role, I think Shannon's instincts as an actor, this is a new kind of role for Shannon. He hasn't really taken this sort of outsized role in a huge commercial blockbuster before. And so there may be sort of a little bit of feeling his way toward the right tone or the right pitch. But I really think his attempts to make this a kind of a complicated villain, a guy who's at least got mixed motives for what he's doing, or he's not pure evil like Heath Ledger's Joker. It's not like that. He's got his reasons and his motivations. But I really, everything has a chance to go wrong at the movies before you get to the casting stage, as I've said before. And I think, although I kind of like this screenplay's structure in that it laces in the flashbacks and at times you don't really expect them. And that's why the thing has this kind of odd rhythm. I mean, good or bad, it's sort of an unusual structure in that you start at one point in Superman's Earth life, and then you're thrown back to his childhood, and then you're forward again and then back. And I actually rather like this, the structure of it, but In terms of scene to scene and moment to moment, it is unrelievedly humorless and heavy-handed.
There's one joke. I think there's one joke that I
and
saw.
And Zack Snyder is as a director, he's not. And then so you add the sort of humorlessness and the very kind of portentous myth-making in the script, and then Zack Snyder, who's really just like a sledgehammer behind the camera.
The structure for me was really frustrating, actually, because it felt like we were getting something of an origin story at first, and then we get a prequel in a lot of ways. Then we were getting a sequel. Then we got a reboot. It's almost like, I don't know how many of these they hope to make, probably as many as are profitable. Right. But we were getting the first four all together here, and it was very chopped up. That didn't work quite as well for me.
You let them handcuff you?
Wouldn't be much of a surrender if I resisted. And if it makes them feel more secure.
What's the S stand for?
It's not an S. On my world, it means hope.
Well, here it's an S. How about...
Sir?
I wonder what it says, though, that we've talked about everyone in the cast, I think.
Except Henry Cavill.
Except Henry Cavill. We haven't mentioned Amy Adams either. I don't think there's much to say there. But is that because Cavill is so bad? I kind of have to go back to the screenplay.
He's not bad.
He could be a great Superman. I just don't know yet. And that goes back to the structure for me, too. Because just as we're starting to get his story, I think the first time we see him, he's as this fisherman out at sea. And he's kind of gone off on his own. And we start to get a sense of who he is, what he's facing. And then, as you said, we're back to kindergarten.
Yeah, I know. It is odd.
It almost undercuts Cavill in a lot of ways. It never allows us to get a sense of his take on the character.
Yeah, yeah. No, it starts out like he's in the middle of a Wolverine movie or something.
Yes,
you know what I mean? Like
yes.
Sort of the, you know, the rugged loner, the rugged shirtless loner who's been to the gym a lot lately.
It's that seafaring work.
Yes,
Michael,
exactly.
It,
and he's also very conspicuously and heavy-handedly, it's pointed out that he's 33 years old, which I think
goodness.
Wasn't he that was the age of old JC, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You're more of a God guy than I am, I think.
That's Jack, also in line with the shot of him when he goes to church. I don't know why all of a sudden he feels the need to go to church, and they frame him with a stained glass window of Jesus in the background.
This is just
some of the heavy-handedness you get in
some
that
of it
area.
Isn't. I mean, that's the thing about the Superman, the whole Superman myth anyway. I mean, some of it is, even though there's just as much coming from, I think, the Torah as the Bible in this story, it's an interesting scramble of both, but it goes beyond just being parallels to kind of a Christ-like parable or something like that. It just flat out is what it is, and it's pandering in a lot of ways. But I mean, it's also, I think, Josh, I think it's why people, you can talk about the box office receipts being disappointing for Man of Steel a little bit. Still, you're talking about several hundred million people going, there's something about the basic building blocks of this story that people do come back to, this idea of this sort of, you know, saintly religious figure from another world who's sort of sent to save humankind. People of all stripes and a lot of different faiths sort of hunger for this in their popular entertainment. And you know, you can argue with the results, but I guess that's why part of the reason people keep coming back to the Superman well.
And I think this movie gets at that the best in those Smallville scenes. I wish there were more of them, or even that they were packed together a little better so they grew in resonance for us rather than just a snippet here or a snippet there.
Good point.
The final scene with Costner, the last time we see him, I think is really effective and also speaks very much to the character of Superman and how he will go on to live his life. But again, we get it just as a little snippet and then we move on backwards or forwards, and it's pretty disorienting. Superman is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You can also find us on Twitter at FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
So you heard what we thought of Man of Steel, kind of mixed to negative, I would say, for both of us. Stick around and find out why listeners saw it or avoided it. Plus, Massacre Theater, stay with us.
Just a young boy standing in the fringes. Just a young boy tied to a rigid life. A quiet place in the corner, made of structure and sacrifice. Just a young boy standing in the fringes. Just a young boy tied to a rigid life. A quiet place in the corner. You would look twice. You would look. Today he would decide of change into another life. And his words, they threw a punch that broke his mother's wrath. And his will, it took a stance that would not be held back.
Just a quick break to remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com. The internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. And by Squarespace.com, everything you need to create an exceptional website. New Squarespace Commerce provides a powerful and flexible e-commerce solution integrated to work with every Squarespace template, allowing sales for both physical and digital goods. For example, you can sell music CDs or MP3s, hardcover books or ebooks. Fast merchant account setup so you can accept payments right away, and single interface for order management, tracking orders, providing customer email updates, printing shipping labels, and adding coupons. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/film. Sign up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just try it out and start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM6 and get 10% off your first purchase of new accounts, including monthly and annual plans. That's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM6.
Until he found himself in the corner with the world watching him now. Until he found himself in the corner with the world watching him now. From the corner the young boy could see. From the corner...
You are unbelievably cute.
Thank you.
Let me see those eyes. What a face. Do me a favor. Turn around for me.
Okay.
No, you know, no, go the other way.
Okay.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. Adam Kempinar is taking the week off. He will be back, I think, especially after he hears what we did to this program, Michael. Well, that was a scene from True Romance you just heard, with Patricia Arquette as Alabama and James Gandolfini as Virgil. Gandolfini, of course, died unexpectedly on June 19. Critics have been expressing appreciation of his work for the last week or so. And Sam Van Halgren, our producer, mentioned a note here about that scene, saying he thought it shows Gandolfini's authority, his subtlety, his danger, and his gentleness. One performance that I thought of right away captured those last two qualities, Gandolfini's danger and gentleness, in one role, and it was actually a voice role. It was his lead Wild Thing in Where the Wild Things Are. It's just such a matter-of-fact performance he gives to a character that's supposed to be dangerous to this kid, yet also somewhat a father figure. So many tones and levels going on there. And he hits them all with his voice.
That's a really wrenching movie, Josh.
I love that movie.
It knocked me out the first time I saw it. And actually, it's not I wouldn't say it's an easy movie to revisit, because the emotions in it are really unusually raw, especially for something that's a, quote, children's film.
Mm-hmm.
My son never quite recovered from me taking to that film when he was 8 or so.
See, I've resisted showing it to my kids because I'm afraid of that reaction.
No, I know.
I think it's pretty powerful.
But
for
a lot of it, I find it comes from a very honest place, and a lot of that comes from Gandolfini's mm-hmm. voice work, because this, as Carol, the wild thing that Max befriends and then has this very tough kind of frenemy relationship with throughout the movie, you get a sense of this monster as an overgrown, unruly, and largely unhappy child that just can't figure out why he feels the way he feels at any given moment. And that, a lot of that is the kind of mixture of emotions that Gandolfini brought to every kind of role. And look, a lot of the roles were the same sort of roles in slightly different angles. You know, like he played an awful lot of hitmen, he played an awful lot of killers.
Sure.
And it's just, you know, you get cast on your looks, and he was the first to say, look, I look like I look, and I do what I do the best I can do.
But he did bring something different to
everything.
So many of them. In Killing Them Softly, a film I didn't really like, I thought, as one of those parts you're talking about, he was one of the best things in the picture.
Yeah, and he had a really direct, I think Gandolfini had a completely direct access to some of the most painful and most revealing sides of his emotional life. And he could really bring that into the character and then bring it to us. And this is why Tony Soprano was worth following season after season, because he wasn't just one sort of killer, one sort of father, one sort of overgrown kid who never really figured out how to be an adult. I mean, all these things made great sense, great emotional and dramatic and then often comic sense of Tony Soprano. And he just had marvelous kind of access to all sorts of things. I think people took him for granted, frankly, Josh, because if we had not had The Sopranos and Gandolfini had simply had the movie career he had, which was good, but I think people took him for granted in a lot of ways, in the same way that people took his skill on The Sopranos for granted after season three. They thought, well, that's great. He can anchor it. He can deliver. But, I think he was that sort of actor. He just saw it as a very kind of straightforward craft exercise of like, okay, deliver what the scene as written requires and just try to bring a little something of yourself to it all the time. And, you know, in that regard, he's a little like Gene Hackman or some other of my favorite actors, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, not too fussy guys like Spencer Tracy, guys like, all sorts of actors. But Gandolfini really, given his look and the sort of peculiar limitations of that so distinctive voice that he brought to everything, the minute he opened his mouth as Carol, the monster in Where the Wild Things Are, there he is. But it wasn't just the same old Gandolfini.
Yeah, but it wasn't jarring to hear that voice coming out of that creature either. It just worked so well. It is time now for Massacre Theater. This is the part of the show where we perform a scene. You get a chance at winning a prize. Last time we massacred this movie.
Champagne cocktail, please.
Yes, sir.
Have you any cigarettes?
We smoke Groom Stewart, sir.
Thank you, sir. Have you got pink champagne?
Of course.
Let me try it.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Could I have a champagne cocktail, please? Sir. Do you have pink champagne?
Of course.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
I changed my table to a table for one.
So did I.
Now, isn't that a shame? After that delightful dinner we had together last night.
Do you speak Gaelic?
Fluently.
How do you say let's get out of here?
That was Cary Grant as Nicky Ferranti and Deborah Carr as Terry McKay in 1957's An Affair to Remember. It was directed by Leo McCary, written by McCary, Delmer Daves, and Donald Ogden Stewart. We had a couple of listeners write in with the tie-ins here. This wasn't one of the most frequently entered Massacre Theaters, but some people did recognize the film and the tie-ins. The first comes from Karen in Chicago.
So Karen wrote, I'm terrible at recognizing these scenes, but I was pleasantly surprised this week to know almost from the first line which movie you were massacring. My mother and I used to stay up late to watch this one whenever it came on late at night. I remember thinking how elegant pink champagne sounded and how disappointed I was to learn it's just rosé.
Yeah, it doesn't sound the same, does it?
The tie-in is to your top five Americans abroad list. The two main characters in An Affair to Remember, Nicky, Cary Grant, and Terry, Deborah Carr, are both returning from Europe to New York on a cruise ship. While most of the voyage is at sea, they do stop at his grandmother's house in Italy.
Ah, so Karen caught the stickler there. We also heard from Sebastian Bonner from New York City. The story of Affair was very similar to the story of how Cary Grant met his third wife, Betsy Drake, which was on the Queen Mary returning from England to the States. He'd just seen Betsy on stage in London and developed a strong attraction, and he was very gladdened by the chance to walk the decks of the ship with her at night, getting to know her. This all comes from Mark Elliott's biography of Cary Grant, Sebastian notes. And he notes that's kind of like Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. You can hear that scene and our review of Before Midnight, as well as our top five lists of movie Americans abroad. That's at filmspotting.net, or you can find the episode on iTunes. All right, Michael, we're going to switch things up a little bit here with Adam gone. Instead of a film spotting hat, would you be willing to draw the winner from this film spotting sock?
A sock, yes, yeah. Here we go. Ben Ritchie, Houston, Texas. Congrats. Sorry about the sock, Ben.
Very nicely done. Congratulations, Ben. You can email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it.
Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is available at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free. All right, Michael, this is going to be pretty obvious, I think. And one reason is that your voice, I feel, matches pretty well with this actor. Has anyone ever told you that without mentioning the actor's name?
June Allison.
Oh,
No, it's not June Allison.
I think this, unless you decide to go a completely different direction, just using your regular voice would be fine here.
Well, yeah, so. Yeah. Anything else would actually require acting, Josh.
Okay. All right. You're going to go first. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Ready. And action.
My colleagues believe that I am wasting my time with you, but I believe you want to do the right thing. It is obvious that you are an intelligent man, Mr. Larson, and that you are interested in the future. That is why I believe you are ready to put your past mistakes behind you and get on with your life. We are willing to wipe the slate clean, to give you a fresh start, and all we are asking in return is your cooperation in bringing a known terrorist to justice.
Yeah. Wow, that sounds like a real good deal. But I think I have a better one. How about I just give you the finger and you give me my phone call?
You disappoint me, Mr. Larson.
You can't scare me with this Gestapo crap. I know my rights. I want my phone call.
And tell me, Mr. Larson, what good is a phone call if you are unable to speak?
And scene. See, that's going to be just too easy. That was a perfect match.
I almost feel guilty that it's better than the original.
Yeah, I know that is a problem with Massacre Theater.
It's the same thing we have in common with Godfather 2.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Deadline is Monday, July 1st.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You are the one they call president?
I am.
I see you are practiced in worshipping things that fly. Good. Rise before Zod. Now, kneel before Zod.
That was Terrence Stamp as Zod and Michael Sebald as the presidential imposter in Superman 2. And we're playing that because one of the reasons, as I mentioned in the review, that I was looking forward to Man of Steel was the new Zod, Michael Shannon. And that was an option in our poll last week. We asked listeners, why would you see Man of Steel? And here were the choices we gave them. Number one, Zack Snyder is directing. Two, Christopher Nolan is producing. Three, Michael Shannon is playing Zod, my vote. Number four, it's Superman. And number five, for the non-comic book superhero geeks, I will not kneel before any of the above. So, Michael, what were the results?
So, number one, Zack Snyder is directing a measly 4%, Josh. Number two, Christopher Nolan is producing 17%. Number three, Michael Shannon as Zod, 24%. And number four, Superman, yes, 27%. But number five, I will not kneel before any of the above, 28%. So, you know what?
Squeaking it out there.
And that points to a certain ambivalence, maybe a slight weariness with this mythology, and maybe this is also linked to why this thing is on a bit of a fade at the box office already.
Martin Cuevas wrote in with his reasoning. He said, it's not that I don't love Superman, because I really do. It's just that I do not think I can sit through 2.5 hours of anything else that has Nolan's name attached to it. I still feel like I'm watching Inception somewhere deep down in my sleepy brain parts. It's been stated in reviews that Man of Steel is completely humorless. That would be true. There's got to be someone on Earth and or Krypton that finds a statuesque white man wearing funky pajamas flying around the town somewhat comical. Anyone?
From Charles Kanzanui, seems like you could put up a similar poll next week asking, who do you blame for Man of Steel? Just replace Shannon with David S. Goyer.
I don't think Goyer did Shannon any favors. That's probably true. Allie said, those cheekbones, that jawline, and my God, those abs. Henry Cavill, well, who had ever heard of him before he put on a muscle suit? I think I speak for the ladies when I say I love Superman. Though I think there are only five of us or something.
And from Art, I chose Michael Shannon as Zod, but there are several other factors involved for me. Zack Snyder's visuals are always worth the watch. I don't agree with that. Even if the film turns out to be horrible, 300 and Sucker Punch are the first to pop to mind. Anything Nolan's name is attached to, I will give a chance. And last and definitely not least, Amy Adams is in it. I have just seen about everything she's done and will watch anything she ever does, says Art.
One here from Nathan Marone, and he also puts in a vote for Amy Adams. I will not kneel before any of the above, he says, but I will kneel before Amy Adams. When all else fails, put her in your movie, and you've at least sold one ticket to me. On the next Film Spotting, we'll be moving on from Man of Steel, but we'll be looking back a little bit. We're going to take a look at the year so far and consider some of the best films from 2013 at about the halfway point. We also want to ask for our poll, who got it the most wrong? There were a number of films that Adam and I split on this year, and so we're going to let you tell us who got it the most wrong. Here are the options. My negative review of Side Effects. I said something about it being increasingly strained and eventually alienating.
This is the Soderbergh
picture.
Yes. Got it.
Adam's negative review of Oz. He called a semi-debacle that thoroughly lacks a cohesive, convincing narrative. Or my negative review of Spring Breakers, which I said was the work of a provocateur without much purpose. Your fourth option, Adam's negative review of The Great Gatsby. Really made me want to dust off my copy of the book, he said. All right, Michael, as the expert, who had it the most wrong of those options?
Josh, I'm contractually obligated not to argue with any of Adam's opinions, so I'm going to focus on yours. Negative review of Side Effects, no, I like that film a lot. It was never going to be a big audience picture, but that's Soderbergh most of his career. I'd also disagree with your negative review of Spring Breakers.
All right,
which is
all right. You're going well beyond the contract now.
I know, but I think that I'm still wrestling with why exactly I found Spring Breakers not simply just salacious and sort of hypocritical salacious nonsense. I think that film actually is kind of weirdly subversive and effective. And I'm a very sensitive 52-year-old white male, so I was not in the demographic for this picture. And maybe I'm in fact, no known demographic.
I don't know. It was empty to me then, and it's only seemed to get emptier as the year goes on. So maybe if I revisit it at the end, I'll give that one another chance. A couple of quick notes here. We are going to try to do a little bonus content, Michael and I. There's a Star Trek Into Darkness email we got a little while back from Kyle in South Dakota. Rather scathing. We've been meaning to give Kyle some time. So hopefully, Michael, you can stick around and we can spend a minute or two on that. If you don't have the Film Spotting app, which you can get for your iPhone and for your Android, that's the way you'll be able to get this bonus content. Also wanted to mention Letterboxd, which is a relatively new movie site where you can review films and keep a diary of what you've been watching, which is kind of fun. You can also create lists, and there's a social media aspect too, so people are often commenting on each other's lists. It's been really enjoyable. Adam has been on it quite a bit, and most recently, he made a list based on Robert K. Elder's The Best Film You've Never Seen, 35 directors champion the forgotten or critically savaged movies they love. Adam interviewed Robert not too long ago, and so he put together a list of all those films. You can find that on Letterboxd. I went ahead after seeing World War Z and just compiled a list and ranked all the zombie films I've seen, which I think has only ended up being about 19. I'm sure there's some seminal ones I missed there.
It seems like we're getting overrun a lot more often than that.
Recently, and it's interesting you say that because I looked on the list, and obviously I need to do more homework, but the majority of them were from the last 10 years, even though I really like a lot of the early Romero stuff too. So it does seem to have picked up recently here. And that was fun to have some give and take in the comments too with people about the list. It only took about 10 or 11 comments, I think, until someone brought up the 28 weeks later, 28 days later is not a zombie film. And that just killed everything. It turned into this wild back and forth between two passionate people on either side. And that was pretty much the end of that conversation.
Because that's a zombie-esque virus, but they're not in fact dead yet. Is that the idea?
I checked out. I was done by that point.
Well, as you say, you need to do more homework. But, you know, I also find it's damn hard to do homework when the zombies are attacking.
This is true.
It's just hard to focus.
Multitasking, Michael. I do have a confession I need to make to you, Michael. We first asked Mel Gibson to come on the show to talk movie Christ Figures, but when he declined, we settled for you.
Great.
I hope you understand.
Great. I'd actually love to do a massacre theater that reenacts some of those crucial phone calls with Mel and his...
Oh, yikes. Dangerous territory there. Yeah. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
For a sunrise, you know, this is not what I had in mind. On to you, but now my arms are getting tired. There's a fall beneath you, and my strength just won't survive.
Hi, this is John C. Reilly, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Koufax. Koufax kicks. He delivers. It's up the middle. It's a base hit. Richardson is rounding first. He's going for second. The ball's into deep right center. Davison over in the corner. Cut the ball off. Here comes the throw. Richardson is rounding first. He goes into second. He's tied. He's in there. He's safe. It's a double. He's in there, Martin. Look at Richardson. He's on second base. Koufax is in big trouble. Big trouble, baby. All right. Here's Kresh as the next batter. Kresh looks in. Koufax. Koufax gets a sign from Roseboro. He kicks once, he pumps, he fires. It's a strike. Koufax's curveball is stabbing off like a f***ing firecracker. All right, here he comes for the next pitch. Kresh swings. It's a long fly ball in deep left center.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. The exciting play-by-play is courtesy of Jack Nicholson as R.P. McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Certainly a Christ figure, but not eligible for our list, Michael, because Cuckoo's Nest is in the Film Spotting pantheon. Another one in the pantheon that easily could have been on this list, probably would have been on mine, is Cool Hand Luke.
How big is this pantheon, Josh? How big is it?
Oh, boy. We're up to about... I don't even want to say I should know this, but I want to say maybe 25 films, something like that. But, you know, with Adam not here, I think you and I could go to the Pantheon Library, move things around a little bit.
Around.
Just, yeah, let's, I mean, come on.
I'm going to argue with you guys on this. I don't think, I don't know if Cuckoo's Nest or Cool Hand Luke belongs in a Pantheon.
In a Pantheon?
Yeah.
All right. Well, when you have 8 hours to spare, bring that up to Adam.
What kind of low-rent Pantheon are you running here? I don't get. I mean, they're good films. I haven't seen Cuckoo's Nest in a long time.
It's been a long time for me, too. Cool Hand Luke I saw for the first time not too long ago and was pretty wowed about it. But let's get into our top five Christ figures here. And how did you form this list? What was in your mind? What came to mind first when you thought of Christ figures?
The parameters, Josh, for me would be very loose because I'm coming at this from my own peculiar sort of agnostic / atheist.
Sure.
You know, I'm not a praying man. I'm not really a guy who... responds immediately or innately to Christian parables in the movies unless they're done just so, and in fact when they are, I'm as much of a fan as anybody. But I do find when it's too on the nose, I tend to resist. So I tend to look more for somewhat more kind of maybe subversive Christian parables a little bit. Or
so when Henry Cavill is in front of that stained glass window, that doesn't work for you.
It's
quite
not
as
well. Jesus-y enough
okay.
for me. But. I guess I'm surprised, Josh, that some of the movies that made my list and some of the characters that made my list really do hit the Jesus parallels head on. And yet, while I typically resist that sort of on the noseness, sometimes in the movies that's what activates the story. So, you know, I'm interested to hear what you have.
Well, I actually resisted this list idea at the beginning just because I grew up with this as sort of a schoolroom assignment. So it felt tedious to kind of revisit. And I'm sort of playing both sides of the coin here because I recently wrote, I think Christian.net, about how Christ figures in the movies as a theological exercise, the practice of identifying Christ figures, it's very reductive. I mean, it's often this surface level game that people play instead of where's Waldo, it's like where's Jesus is what we're playing a little bit. And that actually doesn't really reveal much about the character of Christ. So that did come into play a little bit as I was forming my list. I tried to find those that evoked a quality beyond being just supernatural or a sacrifice being involved in some way and try something other than that surface level similarity. So these should be two pretty interesting lists, how they play off each other.
And no surprise that so many of the films I think we at least considered for this ended up, you know, because of this reductive thing you go through about like, okay, well, who comes back from the dead?
Exactly. That's
it's so much
one.
Science fiction as a result comes into this list, you know, because that's almost, and not just science fiction, but all kinds of supernatural films from Orday to Carl Dreyer's Orday to, you know, all kinds to Starman from John Carpenter. Mm-hmm. I mean, as long as they have supernatural powers and there is somebody, you know, resurrected, then suddenly who are you thinking of? Or, you know, what are you thinking of? Yes, you're thinking of Christ-like parables.
All right. So who have you got at number five?
My number five is E.T., Josh. It's not even my favorite Spielberg film. It's some of the most relentless, heart-tugging anyone will ever survive as a moviegoer and still maybe come out loving the experience. But I think the last half hour especially is an example of Spielberg and all the artists he worked with on this picture kind of working to a very, very high level of somewhat shameless artistry, and also parallels to the Christ story. I think when you get the resurrection, spoiler by the way, when you get the resurrection at the end of E.T., it's not so sanctimonious that you start getting that queasy feeling of like, okay, now we're inflating this science fiction story. We're sort of inflating it full of the wrong kind of, you know, biblical air. It's better than that. It works much better than that. And I think because the film is relatively free of solemnity, and yet you are completely emotionally invested in it, you go with it.
E.T. phone home.
Does this mean they're coming?
Yes. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home.
Stay.
E.T. phone home.
Shut up.
Oh, phone home. Phone, phone, phone.
And honestly, in the same vein, Josh, I think the climax of Close Encounters of the Third Kind is, I mean, my favorite God figure in recent movies, certainly recent science fiction movies, is the mothership in Close yeah. Encounters. I think those are very, very cleverly conceived and executed, you know, parallels to the story we know so well, even if we're not religious.
There's certainly a lot of worship going on in Close Encounters. Yeah, you're right about that. E.T., good choice. That was definitely an honorable mention for me. My number five, though, I'm going to go with Selma in Dancer in the Dark. Now, sacrifice is the most common quality of a Christ figure, I think. And I'll talk a little bit later about why I think that's limited. But you sort of have to have a sacrifice pick on a list like this. Selma is going to be the one for me. She is, of course, the main character in the Lars von Trier musical drama, and she's played by Bjork. Selma's this downtrodden single mother in 1960s Washington, and she has all sorts of troubles, including this encroaching blindness that she's suffering from and the fear that it's also going to happen to her son. To escape this, she imagines herself in these lavish musical numbers, even as she's just working in a factory. Now, some wondered if Bjork Selma was mentally deficient in some way, but I do think that this quality for her works interestingly in terms of a Christ figure. It does help to capture a little bit how crazy his act of sacrifice was and how it doesn't make sense in our earthly terms. We just think about it and it doesn't quite compute. Now, when Selma ends up on death row after this complicated set of circumstances, she actually passes up every chance she has for freedom in order to ensure that her son gets this eye surgery to prevent this blindness that she fears. And then once she receives word right at the gallows that the surgery is successful, she embraces her death in the movie's stunning final scene. It's sort of her "it is finished" moment, I feel like. I know some found this movie manipulative, definitely it's over the top, but I was just so enthralled by these musical numbers. And we should note Bjork did the music as well. She's the reason that this movie works for me more than most von Trier films.
I like it's one of his good ones. I agree, Josh. And I mean, no one likes to, very few filmmakers in the world have ever inflicted so much suffering on their protagonists as Lars von Trier. And a lot of it's just sadistic and in sort of a blackly comic way.
And I feel like Bjork holds up to that. She stands in the face of that with her own artistry.
I agree. And what's happening here, I think, with the use of the musical numbers is what you see in something like Pennies from Heaven, which was the Dennis Potter miniseries done with Bob Hoskins on television for the BBC. And then later, Herbert Ross directed the Americanized film version with Steve Martin and Bernadette Peters. And that's there, too. You're dealing with intense degradation and pain and suffering, and the only escape is this sort of musicals of the mind, of this fantasy realm that the characters flee to under duress. And you have to treat that just so, or again, the movie is over in 20 minutes and you just want out.
Yeah.
But somehow Dancer in the Dark really sustains itself. And I think maybe like Breaking the Waves, another Von Trier film that for me works, you go with it. And you do find that there's this weird exaltation involved just because, and it's not just a matter of sincerity and pure feeling, because I think Von Trier is never 100% in there, in that he's always a bit of a commentator and a sideline figure, kind of undermining his own stories. But it's deliberate, and it's usually very potent.
Well, Bess in Breaking the Waves could easily have been a Christ figure as well. Who'd you have for your number four?
My number four is actually kind of a left field pick that came out of a conversation with a colleague at the Tribune, Chris Borelli, but it's Radio Raheem in Do the Right Thing.
Oh, nice.
You know, a minor character in some ways, but important to the plot in Do the Right Thing, in that he's the one whose boombox, the volume of the boombox is what sets off, you know, Sal, the pizzeria owner, played by Danny Aiello, into this racist rant and this explosion of anger and temper, and then bam, suddenly you got a race riot on your hands.
I just killed your radio.
And he's an innocent figure, kind of a consciously innocent, simple figure, saintly in a way, maybe, certainly an innocent victim of heinous police violence, inarguably in the story terms. But I don't want to overstate this, but I think Bill Nunn's performance in this role of Radio Raheem really kind of helps ground the film and gives it sort of a core of innocence around some very kind of flamboyant and cynical figures. And it gives it a base of feeling that I like. I that's a film I come back to, Josh, every few years. And I mean, I don't really look at it like an overall, like a Christian parable or anything like that. But I think the movie's provocative and unruly enough that it's always going to invite another look.
Well, Do the Right Thing is, I'm afraid, in the film spotting pantheon. It's also among my top 10 films of all time. So
I don't have to talk to you about it.
I won't tell Adam if you don't.
Oh, what's this with the pantheon thing? Okay, I take what I said back about the pantheon. It's a good pantheon.
Okay,
you guys got to get yourself a good pantheon. That's good.
You mentioned science fiction earlier. I'm going to go that way with my number four, Klaatu in the Day the Earth Stood Still. This is one of the sci-fi landmarks, 1951. The director was Robert Wise. And Michael Rennie plays this character of Klaatu. He's this alien who visits Earth to warn all nations to stop their warring ways.
I am leaving soon. And you will forgive me if I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day, and the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. There must be security for all, or no one is secure. Now, this does not mean giving up any freedom, except the freedom to act irresponsibly.
Klaatu is promptly shot by a United States soldier, but then he does escape military imprisonment, and he disguises himself as a normal human in order to further study mankind. So obviously you have the narrative parallels here, especially the becoming one of us part. But I do like this for another reason, too. I like how it reminds us that Jesus was a preacher. Klaatu is a preacher in a lot of ways. He comes to Earth to call us to this better way of living. Now, of course, Jesus didn't bring this laser beam-wielding robot named Gort with him. But as I said, these Christ parallels, they're never quite perfect.
They're not entirely, yeah. Okay, this is wild, Josh. My number three is the same picture, same character. It is. And this is an example of something that is like completely on the nose in the Christ-like parables,
sure.
But somehow in this new setting with this, you know, this alien invasion in Washington, D.C. in what was then contemporary 1951, it feels completely fresh to me. And I like the fact that the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, got very nervous about just how much they're actually painting Klaatu as invincible and essentially God. And I don't know if you know this, but there was a line inserted into the film when Helen asks Klaatu whether or not Gort, this robot, has unlimited power over life and death. And Klaatu explains that he's only been revived temporarily and that power is reserved to the Almighty Spirit. Now, that was a new line. They added that because
I don't even remember that line.
They were, you know, like, add it in, man.
Huh.
You know? And the screenwriter, Edmund North, called the movie essentially, or the Christ-like parables in the film, my own private little joke, he said. And he went on to say, I never discussed this angle with the filmmakers because I didn't want it expressed. I had originally hoped that the Christ comparison would be subliminal. Of course, it's not subliminal, no. Josh. It's all over the thing. And in fact, to the point where Klaatu steals the military uniform of one Major Carpenter, right?
Uh-huh.
Right,
yes,
and then
yes.
he adopts the carpenter, at the end he rises from the dead and he's ascending into the sky, and you can read all this on Wikipedia, but the parallels are on the nose, and that film, Josh, I love The Day the Earth Stood Still, and I love that we both picked it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. For my number three, I'm going to go with something a little less well known, a pretty small film from 1987, Danish picture from director Gabriel Axel Babette's Feast. This is set in the 19th century, and the main characters are a pair of adult sisters who are maintaining what's left of their now-dead father's church on this remote western coast of Denmark. The Christ figure who comes into their lives is this mysterious Babette. She's a refugee from Paris who asks for shelter in exchange for being their housekeeper. And the film chronicles her doing this for about 14 years. Her presence, especially as the cook, really enlivens this community's life together. Now, after these years have passed, Babette learns that a lottery ticket she's held on to all this time from Paris has come up as a winner. So what she does with the money, she takes it and spends it on the preparation of this lavish feast for the community. And it's a far greater gift than they can fully appreciate or even really deserve. This story and the character of Babette works as a Christ figure not only because of its offering of an undeserved gift for nothing, but because of its clear parallels to Christ's Last Supper and this tradition of communion and Eucharist that has followed that. I recently finished a book by film professor Roy M. Anker. It's called Of Pilgrims and Fire, When God Shows Up at the Movies, and this is how he describes Babette's feast, at least one sequence in it. In one of the film's loveliest sequences, the guests toast one another, and then the little flock moves outside to sing under the stars an old song that has been made new and meaningful by the Eucharistic meal they have shared. Like the original love feast, the agapic art of this feast has been given to them in love. So I know this movie, as I said, is a smaller one. It has fairly devoted following among Christian circles, especially because it does get at this special element of that tradition. So Babette's Feast, my number three.
Good pick. I haven't seen that film since when did it come out?
87. Yeah, it's been a while.
Good Lord. My number two would be Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver. Now, this is not a guy who took Christ's teachings, whether one swings with them or not, in the right spirit, I'd say. I think he went too far.
No, he didn't.
He went too far. I think, this is a script and a character in the monologues, in the made indelible by De Niro's readings in the voiceover portions of Taxi Driver that... he refers to himself as God's lonely man, and there's all kinds of biblical, feverish mm-hmm. biblical imagery in this. Someday a real rain will come along and wash all the scum off the streets.
I go all over. I take people to the Bronx, Brooklyn. I take them to Harlem. I don't care. Don't make no difference to me. It does to some. Some won't even take spooks. Don't make no difference to me.
Driver 48th and 6th, please.
Man, you are gorgeous, beautiful little girl.
And it's all such a... this is a film I have constantly come back to ever since I saw it when I was 16. And I really almost didn't have the emotional resources to deal with it. I mean, the violence in it is still just intense in a way that most movie violence, even more explicit than this, and there's not much, is simply doesn't have this kind of unsettling quality. But I think the way Paul Schrader, the screenwriter, and Martin Scorsese, the director, in addition to everybody else that made Taxi Driver what it is, and that goes from, the composer Bernard Herrmann to you name it, it's got kind of a religious fervor without really being explicitly Christian or it's not anti-religious or anything, but it's just got a really marvelous, unstable quality that... it's the dark side of a true believer who has lost his way and doesn't know it, and yet he's greeted as first a martyr and then almost a religious hero by the end because, as Pauline Kael said in her review of Taxi Driver, it turns out New York City is crazier than he is.
I like where you're going with that. Not a traditional pick, but I'm going to pick something similar with my number two, I think. We are talking about our top five movie Christ figures tied in with, of course, Man of Steel. So number two for me, Simone of the Desert. Luis Buñuel's 1965 short feature. It's about a 5th century ascetic who spent 6 years atop a column in the desert in an act of purification and holiness. And I tie this to Taxi Driver because Buñuel is a noted critic of the church and probably would scoff at the idea of Simone as a Christ figure himself. Certainly, I think this movie works primarily as a satire of religious devotion. That's its main thrust. And yet, at the same time, Simone is this interesting Christ figure in a few ways to me. There's the obvious narrative parallel, of course, that he's tempted in the film 3 times by Satan, and Satan appears in the form of Sylvia Pinel. So he's tempted just as Jesus was in Matthew 4. So you have that going on. But there's also this recurring theme in the film of how those around Simone try to use him for their own purposes. If you remember, early on, one of the people gathered around his column is a man whose hands have been chopped off because he was a thief. Mm. And he holds them up to Simone and asks to be healed. And Simone heals them. And the first thing the man does is slap his kid, shove his kid around. So that's just a little touch of what Buñuel's humor is, but also shows how people are using Simone just for their needs. You also have the family who erects a taller, fancier column for him to stand on. They want to honor him, yes, but also that way they can draw attention to their own holiness a little bit. Mm. And you have the priests who offer him a spot in their priesthood. You kind of get the sense they're recruiting him. He's a star player. They love to have him on their team. So all of this, which does tie into the hypocrisy that Buñuel likes to emphasize so much, it also reminds me of the sort of ways people use Jesus today for their own purposes. And we saw so much of this during the North American culture wars, especially. So Simone of the Desert, maybe not an explicit Christ figure, but worked well enough for me.
I like it. I like it. I think my number one, I tried not to make it the most overtly religious film of the list, but I couldn't get away from Carl Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
I just think there are a handful of films throughout film history, silent and sound era, that are completely invested in the concept of true belief at any cost. And I just find to this day, Josh, that Falconetti's performance as Joan of Arc, which is obviously because of the medium and the time it was made, purely visual, but when you see what Falconetti, the actress, puts herself through in the interpretation of these trials of Joan of Arc, especially when you get to the point where she's really at the stake and dying, it's a different sort of screen suffering than most of us have ever experienced before you see that film. If you've never seen The Passion of Joan of Arc, you just simply can't prepare yourself for the intensity of it. And the fact that Dreyer has filmed it in such a way, using the court trial transcripts of the period, that it actually seems, and I think I've even said this on this show, Josh, that it seems like a film made in the 1400s. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like a movie treatment of an ancient true life story. It has a kind of an atmosphere and a religious fervor that is just unique in my movie going experience.
I'm so glad you had that as your number one. It's one of those films everyone does just need to see. It's in my top 20 of all time and probably would have been my number one actually, except both Adam and I recently had that film on our top 5 religious figures list at number one. All right, we are down to our number one movie Christ figures, and mine is actually an animated figure. I'm going to go with the Iron Giant. This is Brad Bird's 1999 feature. It's mostly traditionally animated. It's about a little boy in 1950s Maine who befriends this gargantuan robot that falls from outer space. Here we go with the sci-fi again.
Yeah.
Now, the aspect of Christ that the robot captures is perhaps to me the definitive one. It's the one that most Christ figures also miss, and it's this idea of his death as an act of atonement. The narrative here inevitably involves the government, which comes after the robot, and there's a lot of good sci-fi battling going on back and forth throughout this movie. At the end, we get this climax that involves a U.S. battleship launching a nuclear missile at this little boy's town. They hope to destroy the robot, and what happens, spoiler alert, the robot intercepts it and sacrifices himself to save all the others.
Giant?
Ooga. You stay, I go. No following.
Now, the key here is that this isn't just a sacrifice, which is, like I mentioned, and what Selma does in Dancer in the Dark. That's what most people look for when they're looking for Christ figures. But in taking on the sins of the army on himself, so the sins of this warmongering humanity, really, that he's encountered, the robot not only saves the town, but also creates this clean slate, this new beginning for a restored life to take place. And the movie also has, I'm not going to entirely give away the ending, but there's a hint of resurrection to this story as well.
And what you're saying actually applies so much to the day the earth stood still.
When
you think of it, it's all kind of part of the same. And it just adapts itself very, very easily in the right storytelling hands to this sort of science fiction or fantasy realm. It just does. Yeah. Yeah, good pick.
How about honorable mentions? Any others that you couldn't quite get on the list but thought about?
Terry Molloy is played by Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront. And this kind of gets to the point, Josh, of how easy it is in the movies to evoke and invoke the story of Jesus in whatever stage you want to do it, as long as you kind of get to a certain degree of brutality, pain, suffering, and sacrificial violence.
Yes,
the climactic beating that Terry Molloy, the Hoboken, New Jersey dock worker, takes at the hands of mob boss Johnny Friendly and his goons, It throws you right back into the Stations of the Cross just simply by showing you the kind of bloodied images and anguished faces that we associate with these Stations of the Cross that a lot of us grew up with in various Catholic Church, you know, iconography sort of representations. And again, I'm coming at this as sort of a bit of an outsider just because I was not... My folks were sort of part-time Catholics. So they stopped going to church altogether by the time I was going to Catholic high school, and I was always kind of a rent-a-Catholic, essentially. and now a recovering Catholic, I think.
Are you?
Because the guilt is very deep. But I go to the movies not so much to get any kind of religious faith or orientation confirmed, I'm almost unoffendable on that level because I don't have a very strong traditional belief of any sort. But I do find that a lot of this just sort of roils around in your psyche and your emotional makeup anyway, no matter how much or how little you've had of this. And I guess I find On the Waterfront a stimulating enough and provocative enough allegory in a lot of ways, and it cannot be explained easily, these Christ-like sort of parallels aside, because half the time in Elia Kazan's film, he's basically just trying to kind of get back at his enemies who didn't like him for ratting out, you know, his fellow travelers in the HUAC hearings. And I mean, the whole film feels a little like betwixt and between, and the tensions are fascinating. And that's why it's a good film. I mean, Balthazar in Bresson's, Hazard Balthazar, you know, no ass ever went through more grief at the hands of horrible human beings, but also some trace elements of human love and kindness. I mean, that Bresson, that's not an easy revisit for me, that film, because I do find it very painful, Bresson's film, but there's something, a film like that, Josh, to me, even with its intense focus on the suffering of this animal, it's a different sort of excruciation than you get in something like a film I've beaten up on constantly, but Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ was, I find, one of the most unchristian acts of filmmaking in the history of movies. I think it's the work of it has nothing to do with whatever Mel Gibson is or isn't off screen, but I if you look at that film, I'm sorry, but all I see when I see it is an expression of seething resentment and revenge and prejudice and sort of a unhealthy interest in a supernatural amount of suffering delivered as explicitly and yet as artlessly as possible. Other than that, I think it's a great movie.
Those were your only problems with it, huh? Well, Balthazar would have been on my list. It's currently in my penalty box, so I couldn't pick that. I thought about Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings, but I don't like the militaristic overtones there as much as I like Gandalf. That's another problem you get, I feel, with Christ figures, is a lot of time they come in as this military leader that's going to save whoever else is in the movie, and that doesn't quite work for
me. Let
me
ask you this. Do you have the same problem with Aslan in the C.S. Lewis?
That is almost such a one-to-one allegory that I don't have that problem, though I understand what you mean, because it does have this final battle.
Right.
So it's all in the framework of a battle.
But I see what you mean. It really is just, No, it is a one-to-one.
The other films I considered were The Truman Show, Truman, and of course Harry Potter is talked about quite a bit as a Christ figure. I don't quite see that enough to put it among my top five. Those were our top five movie Christ figures. We'd love to hear your picks or any other comments you have about this show. Just send it to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
A couple of movies in limited release here in Chicago, 100 Bloody Acres. This is a horror comedy about a pair of guys who run an organic fertilizer business who need a fresh supply of their secret ingredient to process in the meat grinder. Spoiler, it's Twinkies. I think they're using Twinkies,
Twinkies
in this one.
Yes.
Also, Andre Gregory, Before and After Dinner. This is a documentary about the life and work of Gregory, the co-star with Wallace Shawn of Louis Malle's My Dinner with Andre. Another documentary coming out, A Band Called Death, which is about a seminal band from 70s Detroit, a trio of African-American teens that was making punk before there even was punk. Another limited-release film, Byzantium, stars Saoirse Ronan and Gemma Arterton as two mysterious women seeking shelter at a local resort in a UK coastal town. When the secret they share is revealed, there are bloody consequences. I think that's because this is a vampire movie directed by Neil Jordan, if I judged correctly from the trailer.
Opening wide this week is The Heat, Josh Larson's number five most anticipated movie of the summer, starring Sandra Bullock as an FBI agent, pairing up with Boston cop, played by Melissa McCarthy, to take down a ruthless drug lord. There's also White House Down, in which Channing Tatum saves his daughter and President Jamie Foxx, and the White House is attacked by a group of paramilitary invaders. This is directed by Roland Emmerich, who destroyed the world to various degrees in Independence Day, 10,000 BC, the day after tomorrow. Nobody loves to kill off a lot of people like Roland Emmerich.
He does like that.
And this is with Maggie Gyllenhaal, Jason Clarke, and James Woods.
I've got to say about this most anticipated movies of the summer pick, The Heat. I hate to admit it because Adam gave me grief for it, but it really shouldn't have been on that list now that we just came from the screening tonight.
I like that. I mean, two-thirds of it I liked, actually.
Two-thirds? There's some good jokes, but that is being pretty generous. Would you say that's your one movie to see this weekend?
No.
What would that be?
My one movie? A Band Called Death is good.
Okay.
It's really good. I had never heard word or note one of this proto-punk band out of Detroit in the 70s called Death. And it's 2 years before the Ramones introduced that sound to kind of a wider audience. And it's a really good documentary. It's not up to the level of Searching for Sugar Man, another great story of an unknown Detroit phenom that never got the exposure he deserved. But it's a really good music doc.
Well, I'm going to have to catch up with that then. I'm going to go back a little bit to World War Z. I really enjoyed that. Not as one of the deeper thinking zombie flicks, but surely an entertaining one. At least it was for me. I don't know that Adam has seen World War Z yet, but I'll have a chance to ask him. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit in 2 weeks when he will be back. For sure, we're going to be discussing our best of the year so far lists. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week was The Bookshop Band. You can learn more at thebookshopband.co.uk. Michael, thank you very much. You made it quite easy to sit down. Well, I don't know if I'd say easy, but you made it much more comfortable to sit here without Adam this week.
It was a biblical honor, Josh.
Where can people find your stuff online?
They can find it at chicagotribune.com/movies, and the Twitter handle is Phillips Tribune.
Excellent. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.